Thank you very much. Yes, well, I'm using local here in the sense that Bobby uses local, like local Club Yao or local G2, but so local for me is a substitute for saying complete non-compact. So local in the sense that you will decouple it from gravity. There's been a lot of fruitful interaction between mathematics and physics and M-theory and G2 holonomy, but I think in some ways then mathematicians have lagged a long way behind what physicists would have liked us to be able to do. So what I want to do today is to give you, one very concrete theorem that I think goes a long way to addressing some of the things that physicists would like to be able to do, and does it in a very high degree of generality, which I think surpasses what was known really on the physics side. Okay. So in the past, then, very few complete non-compact G2 holonomy spaces were known. And there are essentially some classical examples due to Robert Bryant and Simon Salomon. There's a few deformations of those that were considered by physicists in the early 2000s. And if you look in Dominic's book, then you find that there's a proposal that there really should be some QALE G2 holonomy spaces if you make his method work even harder. But that's never been made to work. So what I want to say today is actually there are lots and lots of these things if you figure out the right place to look. So I'm going to start with the theorem, and then I'll spend the rest of the talk trying to explain kind of where does this come from, why does it give you so many things, and how does it fit together with other stuff that maybe you already know a bit better. So here's where you can find the reference. So the moniker is local G2 spaces from local Club Yao threefold. So the kind of Club Yao geometry that the local Club Yaos that we want to deal with will be so-called asymptotically conical Club Yaos. So they potentially have some interesting topology in their interior, but at infinity they become asymptotic to a Club Yao cone. So this is a cone over some five-dimensional smooth manifold. In order for that to admit a Club Yao cone structure, that five-manifold must admit a special kind of metric itself, a so-called Sasaki-Einstein metric. Doing that itself is non-trivial. So given this six real dimensional non-compact Club Yao, then what we're going to do is take a seven-dimensional space that's the total space of some principal circle bundle over this six manifold. Then we want to make one or two requirements on that principal circle bundle. First of all, we don't want it to be the trivial circle bundle, but we do want it to have some Chern class property. So if we have a circle bundle, we can talk about its Chern class, integral second homology class downstairs in the base. We have the Kähler metric of our asymptotically conical Club Yao. We can look at its cohomology class. We take the cup product of those two things. That gives us a class in the fourth cohomology of the base, and we ask that that be zero. So these are the assumptions. We've got an asymptotically conical Club Yao, a principal circle bundle over it, satisfying this Chern class condition. Then what our theorem asserts is there's a small positive number, so that if you're smaller than that, then on this non-compact seven manifold, then there is a circle invariant torsion-free G2 structure, so that when you look at the associated Riemannian metric, it's complete, it's holonomy, or it's if there's some finite fundamental group around, then restricted holonomy is equal to G2. And then this parameter epsilon here is has some kind of geometric meaning that as this epsilon goes to zero, then there is a sense in which this metric collapses with bounded curvature back to the original metric that you had on your base Calabi-Yau. Okay? So this is the main theorem, and I want to sort of discuss where it comes from, and I've also said in this statement, then we can also say a lot more about what the asymptotic geometry of these metrics is, and I'll describe that later in the talk, but for a one-word, one-sentence description, then you should think of it as a natural generalization of the asymptotics of ALF hyperkähler spaces like Taubnut or multi-Taubnut or the Atiyah-Hitchin metric on charge two centered SU2 monopoles. Okay, so this is a purely mathematical theorem, but I would say the interpretation on the physics side is that there's, at least in this local setting, then it gives a very general existence result for M theory lifts of 2A supergravity solutions with only Ramon flux, so no D6 planes. So let me do a bit of propaganda. So why is this theorem so powerful in practice? So the first thing is that it actually works for any asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau. It's completely insensitive to the details of the method that you use to find the Calabi-Yau itself. Another thing that turns out to be very useful is that we do not rely on understanding any further submanifold geometry of our Calabi-Yau. In particular, there are natural generalizations of this with brains, but then you need to understand special Lagrangian submanifolds of your asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau. And at present, any kind of general analytic tool to understand those in a general asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau is absent. So it's also powerful because you have this one single condition that is in some sense relatively simple that you have to verify to guarantee a solution. In some cases, and I will talk about this later, in the case of a so-called small resolution, this condition is automatic. In the cases where it's not automatic, then the kind of thing it does is it places some integrality constraints on the permitted Kähler classes within the whole Kähler cone of Kähler structures. So in any given concrete case, then you can attempt to work out what these constraints mean. And for example, in the case of the canonical bundle of P1 times P1, we can do this very explicitly. So it works independently of the method, but in fact, now there are very powerful methods to construct many asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau threefolds, mainly by using nonlinear PDE, complex Monge-Ampère methods, so you typically don't know very much about them. So it's important that somehow that be the case. And I will explain more about this later, but in some sense, at the moment, the most delicate part in the construction of Calabi-Yau threefolds that are asymptotically conical is actually to construct the asymptotic Calabi-Yau cone metrics. And so, as I said, Calabi-Yau cone metrics are essentially the same thing as Sasaki-Einstein metrics. We will be hearing later in the conference another talk about Sasaki-Einstein metrics, and so I think you will understand more about that there, but this is closely related to Kähler-Einstein metrics of positive scalar curvature, where there's fundamental work on stability, and there's an analogous notion of stability here, which very recently has been proven to be necessary and sufficient. So in some sense, the most intricate part of the story is really here, to find a suitable asymptotic model. If you can find a suitable asymptotic model, then you can kind of fill things in. Okay. So that's the kind of PR. So just to say a bit more now about what is the asymptotic geometry. So if we take a space like Taub-Nut, an ALF, say hyperkähler gravitational instanton, then the basic structure that we want to abstract is that the asymptotic structure is, it's a circle bundle over an exterior domain in R3, or in the dihedral case, a quotient of R3. And then geometric, so it has this topological structure of a circle bundle, but geometrically this circle fiber is then staying of asymptotically constant length, as opposed to growing. So we want to abstract that to higher dimensions. So these were introduced, this name ALC for asymptotically locally conical was introduced by Miriam Svetich and collaborators. But the basic idea is, well, I should think of R3 as a flat cone. And so for a general ALC space, I should just replace that flat cone with any old Riemannian cone over a smooth manifold. But if I want to be modeling Ricci flat ALC spaces, then I should replace this flat cone with a Ricci flat cone. But if I want to do more, and if I want to get sort of holonomy reductions, then I want to impose more on the cone. So if I want to consider G2 holonomy spaces with this ALC structure, then I should ask that this cone itself be a Kolobyao cone. So then I just repeat sort of what I've said, that being the cone being Kolobyao asks that this link is Sasaki-Einstein, and then it's a subtle question in general about whether you have Sasaki-Einstein metrics, but a lot is now known. So all of the G2 holonomy metrics that we produce by our main theorem are ALC metrics in this sense. So they're kind of natural analogs of ALF spaces. Okay. So to demonstrate the utility of the theorem, then let's see how already we can go from, you know, a handful of diffeomorphism types of local G2 spaces to infinitely many. And we can do this even within the setting of so-called homogeneity 1 spaces, where there is an underlying isometric group action whose quotient space is one-dimensional. So this theorem is going to apply just by taking one single asymptotically conical Kolobyao threefold, the canonical bundle of P1 times P1. Okay, so everything in this is joint with Lorenzo Foscolo, who's here in the audience, and Johannes Nordström, who's also a colleague in Bath. So here what we're going to do is, well, so the canonical bundle of P1 times P1, this has a two-dimensional Kähler cone. So we can consider, we'll have a bunch of different possible asymptotically conical Kolobyao metrics on this space. Not all of them will satisfy the conditions of the theorem, but if we take a circle bundle whose first Chern class is m, minus n, where these refer to sort of a Fubini study on metric on one of the P1 factors and on the other P1 factor. If we take co-prime integers m and n, whose product is positive, and we take the circle bundle with first Chern class m comma minus n, then any one of those admits a one-parameter family of these ALC G2 metrics. So each of these metrics has a cohomogeneity 1 action of SU2 squared times U1. So the metric, the asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau metrics on this base will already have an SU2 times SU2 symmetry, and then the extra U1 is the extra U1 of the circle fiber. So again, so I'm just saying, as this epsilon goes to 0, then this metric collapses back down to the metric on canonical bundle of P1 times P1, and the Kähler class is this m times one multiple of omega minus n times the other. So let's think about the topology of these examples. So it's not too difficult to figure out the diffeomorphism type of these m, comma n. And so they're actually diffeomorphic to the product of the three sphere with some two-plane bundle over S2. But this has an Euler class that depends not just on, it only depends on the sum n plus m. So in particular, then the diffeomorphism type of these things depends not on the pair m comma n, but only on the sum m plus n. On the other hand, it's not difficult to verify that if you really make a different choice of m comma n, then the metrics can't ever be, these families of metrics can't be isometric. So when you make a reasonable choice of m plus n, then by looking at different partitions of that, then you will find finitely many one-parameter families of G2 metrics on the same underlying seven-manifold. And you know, as m plus n becomes higher, then you possibly get more and more families on the same smooth manifold. But so already, just by applying it to one asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau, which happened to have a two-dimensional Kähler cone, then we've already got infinitely many diffeotypes. But all of the examples that you get, they all come in this one-dimensional family, and they don't have extra moduli. Okay. So that's one possible application of the.
You said they don't have extra moduli.
So they just have the circle sort of the, but that's it. Later on, I'm going to explain other ones where they have as many moduli as you want. But here we've got infinitely many diffeotypes, but they're all, the only thing you can do is kind of open up the circle. So I felt that I should say a little bit about the asymptotically conical Calabi-Yau theory that we're sort of relying on. In this case, you don't need very much because this Calabi-Yau metric is cohomogeneity 1, and in the simplest case, it's the so-called Calabi metric. Otherwise, then it also has an explicit description first figured out by several physicists. But we, in fact, have a very general theorem. So the following theorem is due to a sort of an assembly by various people. So the kinds of asymptotically conical club Yaos that are most relevant for this case are going to be things that are obtained by resolving a club Yao cone, as opposed to trying to smooth a cone, mainly because we want to have non-trivial, we want to have a non-trivial circle bundle, so we need some non-trivial H2, whereas smoothings tend to have no H2. So I start with a club Yao cone, and I consider a Krepman resolution of it. So a resolution of singularity with trivial canonical model. And then I have a complex volume form that extends the pullback of the conical one. So then the theorem says, well, anytime you've got a two-dimensional cohomology class on B that contains any Kähler metric, then in fact there's a unique Kähler Ricci flat metric on B in that cohomology class, and you know that's just the obvious condition. And you can say quite a lot about how it becomes asymptotic to the cone. So there's a dichotomy. Either the Kähler class corresponds to something in the compactly supported cohomology. In that case, it approaches the cone very fast, rate minus 6. Otherwise, you just get rate minus 2. So special cases of this were done by Joyce in the case where the club Yao cone is just C3 mod some gamma. Van Curvering did the case of the compactly supported cohomology. Goto did the general case, and then the uniqueness statements, the optimal form of those is due to Ronan, Conlon, and Hayohai. So this is assuming that there is a club Yao cone metric. But what the theorem essentially tells us is, well, to construct asymptotically conical club Yao metrics, then first of all, we have to be able to construct club Yao cones, and then we need to know something about their Krepunt resolutions. I mean, or we could do smoothings as well, but that's less relevant for our current purposes. So for instance, if we stick to the toric setting, then in some sense there is now a more or less complete understanding of three-dimensional toric club Yao cone metrics, thanks to Futaki, Ono, and Wang. Similarly, the classification of Krepunt resolutions in the toric case, then Krepunt resolutions correspond to something in toric geometry that you have an associated fan to your singular toric variety, and then you want to do some algebraic operation, subdivide your fan, and those give you the Krepunt resolutions. So without going into details, then carrying all of this out, for example, leads to infinitely many toric AC club Yao threefolds. So in principle, all of those are possible inputs to use in our theorem. In general, though, you will have to then check this condition about which circle bundles will satisfy the Chern class condition. Okay. So I wanted to say a little bit about the club Yao cone thing. So this is the most delicate part of the asymptotically conical problem. And so for a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, it has a natural vector field called the Rabe field. If you take that quotient, then you get a local space that's kind of locally a Kähler-Einstein space. In the case where you really get a Kähler-Einstein manifold or an orbifold, that's called regular or quasi-regular. And in that case, then the existence of a Sasaki-Einstein metric is equivalent to the existence of a Kähler-Einstein orbifold metric or a Kähler-Einstein smooth metric with positive scalar curvature. So that's known to be a difficult problem, but in some sense it's been resolved recently by the resolution of the Yao Tian Donaldson conjecture, but it has this relation to stability in algebraic geometry. But if you want to construct examples, then building on work of Tian from the 90s on the alpha invariant, then if you can compute the alpha invariant and if it's sufficiently large, then you can find lots of examples. So it's difficult, but there are tools that are available. Whether or not there were irregular examples was an open question. It was conjectured not to be the case on the math side, but physicists set us right there, and Gauntlet, Martelli, Sparks, and Waldron found explicit irregular examples, and a lot more work has been done on that since. So going backwards, then there has also been going from maths back. So Tristan Collins and Gabor Zekahidi kind of following up from the work of Chen Dongs and Sun in the Kaler-Einstein-Fano case, then in the case of a Calabi-Yau-Kohn metric, then there is a natural notion of k-stability, and then they have proven the same kind of theorem that if you can verify k-stability, then you will have the existence of a Calabi-Yau-Kohn metric. So I don't want to say very much about k-stability, and I hope you'll probably hear maybe more about it in Dan C's talk, but here we have some affine variety, our cone, sitting in Cn, and then we will have a distinguished vector field, which is the putative Rabe field. It may, in some cases, just be a C-star action, but in the irregular case, it will be a C-star to the M action. And it has to act in a certain way, so with positive weights, but it tests those things. So we have, in k-stability, we have to look at all possible test configurations and how they behave. So because it involves all possible degenerations of this setup, it's difficult to check in practice. But one way where things become more practical is if your variety emits a large automorphism group. So in the presence of a large automorphism group, then you can argue that you only need to worry about degenerations that are equivariant, and that cuts down your possible space of degenerations a lot. So if you make a large enough automorphism group, then k-stability turns into something that's actually kind of combinatorial. So a specific instance of this is so-called, well, in toric cases, it turns out that there's really nothing to check. And that's what underlies the Futaki Ono Wang cases. On the other hand, if you ask for a torus action of sort of codimension one, then you get something like this. And this is this complexity one action. So to give you an instance of this, then I want to talk about a special type of resolution, a so-called small resolution. So typically when we resolve, we will introduce some divisors, but it's small if we don't have any divisors. So in this case, we're in three dimensions, so if we don't have divisors, we'll only have curves. So for us, the important point about this is that if we don't have a divisor, then there will be no H4 in our resolution. And remember, our condition in the main theorem was that this cup of the Chern class with omega was zero in H4, but now H4 is zero, so we have no condition. So all non-trivial circle bundles will do the job. Okay? But that means we need to know a Calabi-Yau cone that admits small resolution. So there is one of those that we know, the so-called conifold, and it has its small resolution. But are there others? So until very recently, the answer was we didn't know. But there's technology there to address this. So if you admit a small resolution, your singularity must be quite special. It's a so-called terminal singularity. Sometimes, and in three dimensions, they're also a so-called compound Duval singularity, so it's maybe not so terrible. So what this means is that it's a there are threefold singularities. They can be realized as hypersurface singularities, where you take three variable plus a four variable with this t at equals zero in C4, and then where when you set f equals zero in there, then what you get is a Duval or an ADE singularity. So so the if I take a typical hyperplane section, then I will get a I will get an ADE singularity. So it was realized, maybe going back to Breeze-Gorm, but more systematically by Pinkham, Friedman, Katz, Morrison. Dave can maybe add other people, but there is a relatively systematic way where you can construct small resolutions using this compound Duval structure by knowing the fact that we know lots about ADE singularities and their partial resolutions and deformations of those. So so there's a whole package that allows you to try to construct small resolutions of these. So if you apply that in one very specific case, so consider the following hypersurface singularity. If I take P is equal to 1, then this is just the conifold, but in general it's a more complicated so-called compound AP singularity. Then using the ideas here, you can show that this has a Kähler small resolution, and you can compute what the exceptional set is and what its Betti numbers are. So there's a chain of P rational curves that meet transversally, that's the exceptional set. It's simply connected, but its B2 is P. So that's maybe the key thing, that it's, so it has a P-dimensional Kähler curve. So this is some Kähler, so this is a cone that has a particular small resolution, but at this stage we don't know that it admits Calabi-Yau-Cohn metrics. So this is where Collins-Cercahedi come along. So what they were able to prove as an application of their K-stability implies Calabi-Yau cone metrics, and the fact that in this particular case these things admit a C-star action, then they showed that this indeed admits a Calabi-Yau cone metric, where there's a particular guess for what the most obvious rayed vector field is, and that's the obvious thing is what you should use. So the upshot is just that using this highly non-trivial K-stability implies Calabi-Yau, and checking that this is K-stable, then they were able to prove that there is a corresponding Calabi-Yau cone. And it's one of these so-called quasi-regular ones, and the smooth topology of the cross-section is that it's a connect sum of P copies of S2 times S3. So now, because we've got a Calabi-Yau cone and because we've got a small resolution, then the general theorem for AC Calabi-Yau threefolds tells you there's a p-dimensional family of Calabi-Yau structures on this.
They're actually p-factorial distinct small resolutions.
Well, there's lots we haven't, so yes, that's a separate question. So, I've just chosen one, and then for each of those, but a separate question is how many of the other ones, as long as you've got a Kähler resolution, then that's everything will be fine, yes.
So it's always Kähler. And the difference is in the last two variables. I mean, so the read vector should work for the write vector, so it should work for all of them, I would think.
Well, this is just that's just for the cone. So everything, I mean, you've completely separated now kind of a purely Kähler question about do you have a Kähler small resolution from the metric information. So if we have chosen one small resolution, any other small resolution will also have the same properties.
I should point out that the choice is you had a polynomial in two variables of degree t plus one, which factors into the linear factors, and you've chosen an order for the linear factors. That's the essential. That's why it's being said.
So put this together with our main theorem, and then what you learn is, well, so take a circle bundle over this, fudge things a little bit if you want to make things simply connected. Just a further finite cover can guarantee that it's simply connected. Then this M is a seven manifold that carries now a p-dimensional family of complete ALC G2 metrics up to scale. And moreover, when you take two different values of p, then you get non-diffeomorphic examples. But in some sense, we have found easier ways to find non-diffeomorphic things, and so the new thing that you learn is all the other ones were coming in one-dimensional families. These ones can come in moduli of whatever dimension you like. So that's sort of the end of maybe the propaganda here. So let's return to the theorem, and then so the theorem is all about circle invariant G2 metrics on a circle bundle. So to see what actually makes things work, we have to now go back and look at these equations for circle invariant torsion-free G2 structures on principal circle bundles. So this has some history. So it's been considered previously both by mathematicians, so Simon Salomon and Vestislav Apostolov, so Simon is here, and also by various physicists, including this collaboration. So in some sense, you should think of this as a G2 analog of the Gibbons-Hawking ansatz that constructs circle-invariant hyperkähler four manifolds via harmonic functions or abelian monopoles, but it's going to be more complicated. So we want to have a circle-invariant G2 structure phi. So we're going to write it in the following way. So we're going to have a six-dimensional base, the quotient. On that, we're going to have an SU3 structure, which has a two-form omega and a holomorphic or a complex three-form capital omega. There's a metric induced by that SU3 structure. There's a positive function, and then there's a connection one-form theta on this circle bundle. So you construct the three-form out of the connection and the two-form, and the real part of the complex volume form, but multiplied by this power of h. You can then see that the induced metric has this sort of slightly reminiscent of Gibbons-Hawking form, and the Hodge star of the three form is then instead given by omega squared and theta wedge, the imaginary part, again corrected by suitable powers of h. So the key thing is to understand what the conditions for these to be closed and co-closed are. And so just stare at these and then, well, differentiate this and take the right part of that. You'll see this one here. Then you get theta wedge d omega there, but the theta can't kill it, so we must have d omega is zero. So this is the condition that this be closed. now apply D to this, and you get the same things here. This is the condition to be co-closed. So there is some freedom in the way that you choose this conformal factor in front of the B. Our choice is motivated by the fact that the way we've done it, if your three form is closed, then the two form is closed. So this B6 is always a symplectic manifold, and that's very useful for us. There are alternatives that appear to be used in the physics literature, the string frame, but we haven't found such a good use for that yet.
Mark, in the second line, should it be H to the quarter, not H to the minus?
I would have to. Yes.
Certainly.
Yes. Yeah. What I. Yes. That to have that correct. Those two are inconsistent. Yes. That should be a plus. Thanks. So the other thing to notice about this row here is, well, first of all, it tells you omega is closed, so we have a cohomology class. So now look at this. This is the curvature of some connection, so this is C1 of M. So this tells us that this was D of something, so C1 cup omega is 0 in B4, H of B4. So this condition here that we introduced is not some artificial condition, it's something forced on you right from the beginning. And the thing is saying, provided that you satisfy this one necessary condition, we're going to be able to solve.
So if you had these six primes, the condition would presumably be the class of the six
primes. Yes. Yeah.
I'm just
yes. There are numerous ways. So first of all, this is not like the Gibbons-Hawking ansatz. This is a shed load of complicated nonlinear coupled equations. So if you were hoping that the world was as nice as hyperkähler geometry in four dimensions, then I'm sorry, it's just not. The question is, what can you do anyway? So in general, If you can give me the general solution to that equation, then great. But I don't believe that you'll be able to do that. The thing is that we'll be able to do enough to get us to substitute for it. But maybe the first thing that gives you some extra insight into this is to rephrase these things in terms of, well, I have an SU3 structure, so SU3 structures we can decompose. We can look at their torsion. If I have a solution to this equation, what does it tell me about their torsion? So just to remind you, so I've got, for an SU3 structure, I've got little omega and real and capital big omega, so I can look at their derivatives and I can decompose them into SU3 invariant components. So what I've got is a pair of one forms, a pair of functions, a pair of two forms that are in fact primitive 1-1 forms, and then a three form which is of so-called type 12, and another pair of one forms here. So they satisfy this. So you're not supposed to intake this if you haven't really seen it before. The special thing is, well, a solution of this has almost all of these components to be zero. So the only possible non-zero ones are this W5, so W5 is a one form. You take D of your function and take 1 over it, an appropriate power, I mean appropriate constant. Or this W2, this is supposed to be a primitive 1-1 form, so what you do is you take your connection, you take its curvature, that has, again, is a two form with various pieces. You project it only into the primitive 1-1 piece, and then you multiply it again by this power of h. So those are the only two possible thing. So from a torsion point of view, they are really very special. But note, however, whether or not the almost complex structure associated with this is integrable or not depends only on the ones and the twos. But we have possibly a non-zero W2. So when this W2 is non-zero, we're forced to deal with non-integrable SU3 structures. Okay, and typically this will not be zero. So a further observation is that this pair, H and theta, which I want to think of as sort of like a monopole in the three-dimensional case, indeed satisfies some kind of monopole-ish kind of equation, except that now rather than taking star of d theta, I have to do this wedging with the three form to get back to the right dimension. Okay. So the main thing that we want to do is, even though this system is not manageable in general, then in some limit where everything is sufficiently collapsed, then it will kind of effectively linearize, and then I can deal with it, but I can no longer deal with it by finding explicit solutions, but I can deal with it by analytic methods, by solving those linear systems. So I imagine I have a family of invariant torsion-free structures with circle fibers that collapse, and then I make a normalization to sort of understand that. So I do some renormalization of the lengths of the fibers, and then I rewrite everything. So I get something that looks a bit messy. But the first thing now is I want to imagine taking this limit as epsilon goes to zero. So the first thing is stare at this equation here, set epsilon going to zero, this goes to zero. This will now say dH is zero. So H0 should be constant. Without loss of geometry, I make it 1, and then the remaining equations say this is a Calabi-Yau. So epsilon has gone to 0, so I've got d of this is 0, d of this is 0, so I've got a Calabi-Yau. So this is completely formal, but then we want to try to approximate this for epsilon positive by linearizing about this Calabi-Yau structure. So I just start expanding everything in powers of epsilon, and then start to see what equations do I get at the linear level for H, theta, sigma, and rho. So this, I haven't really explained what that rho hat is here. That's the explanation of what it is. In three dimensions, we have a stable three form, and so knowing the real part tells me the imaginary part, and now I linearize that, that's what rho hat means. That's the whole thing that would be required to tell you what it is. If you want to see it later, I'll come back. So you write down what those previous equations are, you get this. Assume that this is, say, a fixed symplectic manifold, the sigmas can drop out, and then instead I get a slightly simpler equation. But the key thing now I get is that if I solve this linearized Apostolov-Salomon, then really now on the Calabi-Yau, I really get this Calabi-Yau monopole equation. So this is precisely the kind of higher dimensional analog of the monopole condition in Gibbons-Hawking. And again, because now d, so that should be a zero, because d of this is zero because it's Calabi-Yau, taking d of that means h is harmonic. So because it's harmonic, in many cases, it must actually be constant. So for instance, if b were complete and the function were bounded. So if the function is constant, that term there is zero, and then this actually says you have a Hermitian-Yang-Mills, abelian Hermitian-Yang-Mills connection. So what you want to then do, I'm just going to wrap up now since I'm essentially out of time. So the first thing that we want to do is, we're given a Calabi-Yau monopole, then it will determine a infinitesimal deformation of our complex volume form. The way that it does it is, so now we think of these things as given, and now we have a linear system, a linear inhomogeneous system, where we're trying to find rho and rho hat. So for instance, in the Hermitian-Yang-Mills connection case, H is 1, so this term disappears. This term disappears, so we're saying d rho is 0, and d rho hat is 0, and d rho is this. That then makes these all closed G2 structures. So to try to do perturbation theory for G2 structures, then we better at least get something closed, otherwise things are hopeless. And once again, this condition, you see this condition here, because again, get rid of this, and now d theta wedge omega is d of something, so I better have that. So maybe the last thing I will say before is, you know, to actually solve this, then it's more convenient to be able to use, you know, usual elliptic analysis on your manifold. So you can actually rewrite this equation in terms of d and d star, and then understand you're trying to solve this elliptic problem. In general, there'll be some obstructions, and precisely this Chern class condition here will show that those obstructions vanish. So once you can construct an approximate solution, there's still a lot more work to do. That's the scheme. I'll stop there.
Just a quick one. You've fixed the symplectic form at the end. Would it be possible to try and see what happens if you fix the almost complex structural? That'd be too unwieldy. I only ask because in there are some sort of examples, some sort of half complete G2 metrics in which you do have a sort of fixed almost complex structure. So it's it, you know, it's a natural condition, I think.
I mean, from our point of view, it was to try to do a general theory, then fixing symplectic is the nicest thing, partly because you can use kind of Moser stability type things, so that at some stage you have to worry about some gauge fixing issues, and the most uniform treatment seemed to be using that. But
it's more than that. You're not losing anything, because there was this theorem about the existence of an asymptotic conical Calabi-Yau metric in each Kallek class. So then, sort of, and you know that the Kallek coordinates for this asymptotic conical Calabi-Yaus, it's an open set inside the cohomology. So that restriction is really just saying it's nothing. I mean, if you're free to deform the Calabi-Yau metric subject to that topological constraints, then you're varying it. So, but really, I mean, there's corrections to the almost complex structure at every order when you try to solve these Apostolos-Salomon equations.
I should say, so the fact that at the first approximation you are putting in a Hermitian-Yang-Mills connection that exactly says you have some non-zero primitive 1-1 piece, that is exactly saying that this W2 thing cannot stay zero in what we're doing. So you're forced to deform the almost complex structure, and you're forced to do it in a non-integrable way. But you know, it's a small deformation that we're doing. But,
Other questions?
Let's start Mark again.